And in this hour, the absolute number one topic on the radio at all times is gardening. And we are going to have the rest of the hour is going to be gardening for about 45 minutes here. And with me is Velma Biddick, Abby Alla, and Lou Hyde. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming in. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome.
I know it's beautiful out, and the weather is great. And what's that said, farming saying? Well, the corn's not high yet, but a lot of things to do this time of year in the garden. And Abby, let me ask you about that. You mentioned that earlier, that you got plenty of things to do. What kind of things are you doing in your operation at this time of year?
Well, I have several thousand starts that I need to get into an acre of outdoor gardens. And I'm not a gardener, just a little collection. I am a producer, mm-hmm. a farmer. A gardener has a little plot behind their house.
Ah.
And we have 14 greenhouses and an acre of outdoor gardens.
You have 14 greenhouses now?
Yes.
Oh, my. I remember years and years ago, wow, that was a lot of greenhouses.
So we have lots to do. Three mm-hmm. of the greenhouses are hydroponic, and then the others are in-the-ground greenhouses,
wow.
hoop houses.
Well, I promise that we will have this show go by lickety-split so you can get back to work on this beautiful day out there. Because,
yes.
you know, honestly, the forecast for the weekend does not look that good.
Oh, dear.
Well, I mean, I don't know. For farmers, rain is important, right?
Yes.
let me give out the phone number for the studio, and that is 283-8414. We're taking your phone calls. If you have any questions about farming, produce, growing things in general, if you have questions about local foods and producing that, our phone lines are open, 283-8414. Velma Biddick is here. Let me ask you, what are you doing this time of year on your back 40?
Well, I have all of my sets in. My squash is up about 2 feet. My cucumbers are up about 2 feet. I usually wait until the 1st of June to get everything in. But this year was a little early, and I know there's some adventurous souls out there who have put their starts in early, but heads up, the long weather range weather forecast says it's going to be nice for 2 weeks, and then we're going to have another dip. So get ready to prepare for that dip in your microclimate.
Oh, I will ask you about that later. Remind me to. Lou Hyde is here as well. Welcome back. You were here just this morning.
Yeah, I've seen you somewhere.
Yeah. and I because you were here earlier, I know for a fact that your garlic is already a foot tall. How are things going on your operation?
They're going very well. Mine's not quite as big as theirs. I have just about everything in the ground. I have two little tiny greenhouses that I need to fit out for special plants. And then I'm going to just sit there and watch stuff grow.
Abby, you brought some, I imagine they're yours, some visual aids.
These are cucumbers.
They are far larger than
large cucumbers that we just picked, and they're hard as a rock because they're fresh, and there's no pesticides, herbicides, or fungicides on them.
Oh, wow.
And so you could just go out in the garden and start chewing on them.
How did you get them up so early, this big? I mean, there's one, folks who are listening, there's one that's 13 inches and one that's probably 17 inches long here. How did you get them so early?
Well, we start in January, February.
Oh, no kidding.
And then these are hydroponics. So they're sweet. Even though they're huge, they're still very good tasting because hydroponically, they have so much water with them that they're never dried out.
Oh, uh-huh. Is it true that the interior of a cucumber is cooler than the ambient air? Is that why the phrase cool as a cucumber?
I have no idea.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Thank you.
And melons are the same way.
Oh. Well, that makes sense. They're full of watery stuff. Well, tell us more about these. Is this typical of what you're producing in your greenhouse year-round?
We don't produce year-round.
Oh, okay.
Because it's too expensive to light everything.
Mm.
And so, we don't produce year-round.
Ah. You know, I remember a presentation. It may have been from Alan Boris, but it was a discussion about how the Russians wound up not staying in South Central Alaska and wound up having to go to the southeast and then further down the coast. That's because they didn't think they could farm here. They couldn't grow enough food, and they were shipping it from Siberia to here to try to sustain their people. And of course, you can't have a very big population doing that. But apparently, you three have proven Alexander Baranov wrong.
Well, my folks came in 1948, and we've been farming ever since. So, wow.
You have one of the things that they probably didn't realize, and Abby's a good illustration of how this works. It takes about 5 years to turn a forest into agricultural land.
Oh,
I've got that on very good authority from a guy named Elliot Coleman. He told me personally that it took him 5 years to turn a forest in Maine into a producing farm. Abby's family's been here for a lot more than 5 years. My farm's only about 4 years old, so it's still in diapers, really.
Now, what is the process? Is it just changing the soil to something more conducive to produce?
First, you have to clear.
Yeah, got a couple of years of clearing. You've got to pull the roots out. Our soil here is very compact and dense, and there's not a lot of vegetative matter in it. I had a celebration a couple of years ago when I found earthworms.
Oh.
But it's going to take 5 years. When I lived in Anchorage, I bought a brown lot, and it took 5 years to turn that brown lot into something that would support plant life.
When I moved down here in 1982, we talked to an old homesteader, and he knew I was interested in gardening. And I looked at my 6 acres, and I thought, where do I start? Because it was all heavily wooded. And he said, find an alder patch. He said, clear the alder patch first. He says, that's where you grow your garden. Because forests and woodlands go through a cycle. And you have your mosses and your sedges and your conifers, and then you have your broadleafs come in, and it all changes from acid toward the basic or neutral. And alders are a nitrogen-fixing plant, and underneath the alder there is huge amounts of duff, and the soil biome has a tendency to be a little more bacterial than fungal. In your acid soils, your bacterial workings tend to be more fungal, and so you want ground that is moved toward the bacterial. And so alder patches are conducive to putting in vegetable gardens. It'll save you about 2 years, and the root mass and the organic material is just incredible. My dad, the first year that we had turned everything under, he's a farmer in Idaho. He came in, and I said, where have you been? And he says, I've been down there hoeing that rug you call a garden spot. There was so much organic material in it that it was really hard to handle. But that first year, I had broccoli that got 36 inches tall, and I had celery that the stalks, after they were trimmed, were 29 inches. And I had added no inputs. So I tell people if they have bad soil, go somewhere and do some mining underneath an alder patch, because that is a natural way to improve your soil.
Wow. What is nitrogen fixing?
They're little bacterial nodules that grow on legumes that fix nitrogen into the soil, and alfalfa, vetch, up here alders. Those are plants that fix nitrogen in the soil. They take what's there naturally, and they condense it and hang on to it.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Yeah, the plants make fertilizer for everybody.
Ah, nice. You know, speaking of nitrogen, and I have no way of knowing if this is true, but I heard that plants are almost all made out of nitrogen, that their actual atoms that they're made from came from the nitrogen in the air more than the soil in the ground. Does that make sense?
Plants are mostly water.
Mm.
And then you've got the cellulose that makes up the structure. Nitrogen furnishes, it's a macronutrient, and it furnishes the a plant with the ability to do chlorophyll synthesis. Phosphorus is, it's another macronutrient. It's, those are the nutrients that you see on commercial fertilizer, the
NPK.
And so the phosphorus, our soils in Alaska are notoriously phosphorus low. And so the phosphorus helps with the root systems. You use a combination of macronutrients when you set plants out that are high in phosphorus because of the root system, and then it helps to form blossoms and plants. The potassium is healthy. It kind of keeps the plant balanced so that it can uptake all of the micronutrients that are available.
Wow. Abby's got the thumbs up. How difficult is it to maintain? Is it purity I'm looking for? What is the word I'm looking for with natural food? Well, natural probably. Organic is the word I'm looking for. Is it difficult to maintain organic farming and such with using commercial products, or is that?
There are some commercial products that the National Organic Institute okays for organic growing, but generally organic fertilizers are low acid fertilizers. There's nitrites and nitrates in the commercial fertilizer, which contributes to salts in the soil. And then organics don't have those high levels of nitrites and nitrates. So those act as poisons to your plants. But while we're on the fertilizer, we use way too much fertilizer, whether it be organic or commercial. And the reason that we use too much fertilizer is because we don't have our soil pH the way it is, the way it should be. It should be as close as we can get to basis, which is 7. Now, the only way that I can explain to people the importance of pH is if you have a gallon of water and you're drinking that water every day. Pretend you're a plant and you're drinking that water every day. If you are at 7 and neutral and you've got a basic there, that water is good. Now, our pH scale is a logarithmic scale, which means that if you are at 6, you have 10 times as much acid as you do at 7. Okay, now I am going to throw this little scenario at you, and you think about it. You're drinking water at 7. At 6, let's put 10 tablespoons of salt in there.
Wow.
Now your water is salty. If your pH is at 5, you put 90 more tablespoons of salt in there. If it is at 4, you put another 900 there.
Wow.
Now, think about being a plant trying to grow in that.
Wow. Are there...
The average pH in Alaska soil is 3.8. And in rare cases, you'll find a little bit of alkalinity, which is about an 8.2. Very rarely. So, when you're growing something, if you are below 6... your fertilizer won't uptake. It will bond with that acidity, and it will tie up your nutrients so that your plant can't get them, and it will actually tie up your micronutrients, which are your manganese, your copper, your boron, all of the things that, it's like a human taking a vitamin pill. If it can't get those micronutrients, it's going to grow, but it's not going to taste good, and it's not going to be healthy. If you've got a potassium shortage, you're going to have yellow leaves. So there's things that you can do. But if you're serious about gardening, get a soil test. They're worth the money 100 times over. Because you can have plants that grow, but you're poisoning them, and they're not uptaking the micronutrients that they need. So that remember that scenario. Oh, my soil tested 5.5. Think about that 1,000 tablespoons of salt in your water.
In a gallon of water. Wow, that's crazy. And where are these soil tests available?
You can get the information for them down at the Cooperative Extension Agent. There's several places that you can have them done. You'll get a basic test. They can add things to them. But if you, let me put it this way. You can get $100 worth of soil tests, and those $100 worth of soil tests will do you more good than $500 worth of fertilizers and amendments.
Everybody is nodding their head in agreement. I actually had no idea that was that important. I figured the fertilizers and the amendments just fixed the soil, just made it magic. And clearly that's not the proper way to go.
People make the mistake of looking out in the woods and they're going, oh, everything's growing good out there. But all of those plants are growing in soil that is good for them. They seed themselves and they grow where it's good. The ones that get in soil that's bad for them, they die and they don't thrive. And the forest and the ground has its own system for renewing and succession planting. So the forest changes over 100 years as plants acclimate to the soil pH as it changes.
Oh.
We have a tendency to pick out a plot of ground and we throw plants in and then we go, they're not growing. So pH and soil tests are really important.
Wow.
And Jay, your assumption that throwing a bunch of chemical at the ground is really at the root of some of our serious food problems that are on the horizon. There are areas in the Middle West where there are no soil bacteria because they've been throwing heavy-duty chemicals at the plants for years, and the bacteria are died out.
Wow.
Yeah.
And in the meanwhile, fertilizer runs off into the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
Causing algae blooms in the Gulf of Mexico and dead spots.
Now the newest trend toward mono farming is they're foliar feeding and they're tissue testing for the biome, for the bacteria, and they're actually spraying it on when they low-till. They're using it on the surface so that the organic material that is laying on the surface is reseeding some of those bacterial colonies. So they are learning. They are moving in that direction. It's slow going for some of them, but it is happening.
Abby, how do you prepare and treat your soil?
Well, we have horses.
Oh.
And so we were putting up one greenhouse, and I put about 18 inches of raw manure. You have raw manure, aged manure, and compost. So just because you have a pile of old manure doesn't mean that's compost. And so it was a mess, you know, and it was raw, new manure. And the next year was pain to deal with because it hadn't worked into the soil all that well. And our last soil test, we did one last year. The last soil test I did, and we take soil tests on all the different greenhouses and the garden. So everything is soil tested, and we have a binder from years and years and years of soil tests so we can see how things have gone through the years. And that greenhouse, now that it's 5 years along, it has the best soil in our whole farm. But it's taken years for it to break down and to be able to work its way to good soil.
Have you guys seen the movie The Martian?
Oh, yes.
Matt Damon is an astronaut, and he gets stranded on Mars. And he farms because they actually have some potatoes, real potatoes, mm-hmm. in the space habitat. And he goes and harvests all the poop that they made mm-hmm. While waiting. And then he you know, takes soil from the Martian soil, and there's quite a segment in there because mm-hmm. the character is a botanist. Mm-hmm. And so he knew that the soil needed to be fixed up. And so mm-hmm. there's a whole segment of him in there making his soil good so that then mm-hmm. he can plant potatoes and survive.
There's a really good book whose name I can't mention on the air. It's called Holy Bleep. you can get it at a couple of the bookstores and I think Kenai Feed around town. And it's about using manure to various kinds of manure, including humanure. To feed your soil. Mm. Feeding the soil will feed the plants. We really don't just feed the plants. We feed everything that lives in the soil. Jeff Lowenfels out of Anchorage wrote a really good book called Teeming with Microbes that is a great reference if people are interested in this.
Right. So feeding all the things in the soil makes the soil just better, right? And what am I thinking here? And that helps the plants, of course.
Well, there are all kinds of both organic and inorganic chemicals in the soil naturally. The metals, the salts, the calciums, which we don't have enough of, things like that. But the plants can't access them without their microbial helpers that break down these little grains of, pardon me, little grains of silt and turn them into organic chemicals that they can use.
Now, microbial means like bacteria or fungus. That's okay. Mm-hmm. And those things show up naturally, or can you add those to a soil as well?
You can add them.
Oh.
Dave Ianson over at Natural Resources Conservation Service actually has done some serious original research on microbial colonization. He did a project after Mount St. Helens to find out how long it was going to take for the microbes to grow back, and he's a great resource. I hope you're listening, Dave.
You know, down in Kodiak, where I've been for a while, the city, because of a new law, they couldn't take their sludge from the sewer treatment plant anymore and put it in the landfill. They just couldn't do that anymore. So they in Kodiak, there's a lot of wood chips because there's a lot of logging and a lot of wood chips. So the city started composting the sludge from the human waste out of the sewage treatment plant with the wood chips, and they started giving away. And then there was a fella in town who started doing it commercially and took all of that stuff off the city's hands, which would have cost them thousands of dollars to do away with. But there was a controversy with using the human, I guess it's dried effluent, so it's sludge. And that's actually a technical term. is that a concern? I mean, you don't see people in the old times, you know, farming where they're pooping. Or do they? Did they?
It depends on where you were.
Oh.
In the Himalayas, it was considered bad manners not to go out in the cornfield and fertilize something.
Oh.
In Asia, they've always used humanure.
Yeah.
Really?
It's just, it's a way to recycle what you've got. And it was not left open. They covered everything up. The American Indians also used that method because that was the only, to have a really sustainable system, you have to have an animal of some kind to produce the necessary cellulose breakdown that is in plants. We don't break down cellulose really well. Bacteria and stuff does, but horses and cows, and they break down cellulose. That's why manure is such a good source of your inputs, is because it adds organic material and it adds biome to your soil. Now, compost has got biome in it. So when you put compost on, you're reseeding. Everywhere you put compost, you're reseeding your soil with bacteria that has been growing like crazy in that compost. Compost is not sterile. It is alive, and it smells good, and it feels good. It's wonderful stuff.
Now, and I want to dispel what might be a misunderstanding on some people's part. None of us use any kind of humanure.
Oh, yeah.
To fertilize it. For one thing, it's against the law.
Oh.
if you're producing for human consumption, you simply may not use it, because there's no way to be sure that just anybody is going to compost to the point that they kill all the potential germs.
Oh, sure. And I think there's some concern about concentrating of heavy metals or other things.
Well, there's estrogen, and there's pharmaceutical residue, and you know, you have to be careful with your inputs. A few years ago, people were going to the dump and they were getting leaves and they were getting this and they, but most of the lawns that the municipality has have been treated with broadleaf killer to get rid of dandelions. Well, guess what? Everything you grow in your garden is broadleaf. So if you compost that and the residuals are in that grass, you're putting broadleaf killer in a concentrated form on your lawn.
Oh, man. That would ruin your day.
Okay. Yeah. And they spray for bugs.
Right.
So now you've got pesticides and insecticides. You just have to be careful with what you're inputting. I try not to input anything that isn't off of my place. No Roundup, no pesticides, no herbicides. And we're lucky up here because most of us farmers are isolated enough that if our neighbors are using it on their lawns, they're far enough away that we're not getting it. We raise bees, and bees are really sensitive to Roundup because Roundup goes into the plant, it's in the pollen, the bees take it, they fly a mile home to you, and they put it in their nest and they feed their babies. So we're lucky up here that we don't have a lot of cross-contamination with Roundup and herbicides, pesticides.
Wow. Did you hear about that lawsuit settlement here?
Oh, yes. Great, great, great.
It's $3 billion or something? For the listeners, a lawsuit against Roundup, jury found that it caused cancer.
They've known for years that it causes cancer.
You know, they...
And it doesn't go away. It goes into the ground. Now they're putting it on alfalfa. For years, I used alfalfa pellets as a soil stimulant. They've got a growth stimulant in them, and it's wonderful conditioner for your soil. But now you have to be really careful and get the organic stuff that hasn't been sprayed, because the cow eats it, the cow leaves it in a pile, they gather up that pile, they put it in a compost pile, they dry it, they sell it as steer manure, and if it's been treated with Roundup and you put it on your ground, you're liable to have some real serious problems. Even your starting mixes anymore that have been contaminated with Roundup. I bought 2 bags of a national brand of starting mix. I planted one whole bag with, filled all my cells, planted it, filled the other one. Nothing came up in one bag except just a few little plants. And when you picked them up, they had no roots. The little embryo tried to come up and grow. That bag came from a different lot, and it was poisoned with some kind of herbicide or chemical, because it killed everything.
Wow.
400 little plants didn't germinate, and the other ones came up.
Huh.
So you have to be careful. When you buy a bag of starting mix, I've learned. I take a quart out, I fill 3 or 4 sets of cells, I put different seeds in it. If they don't come up healthy, I don't use that bag. I pitch it, and I don't pitch it anywhere on my place.
Oh, right.
I put it in the garbage, and it goes to the sanitary landfill with the other garbage and grass clippings got round. I hate Roundup. Now, I come from a background that I'm familiar with it. We were farmers. My husband was a licensed hazardous materials applicator for Shell Chemical Corporation for 20 years. Him and 11 other men that worked in that plant all died.
Wow.
From cancer. They worked Tech material. Tech material is the strong stuff that they mix with the carrier. So when you buy a chemical out of the store to put on your ants, and it says there's 2% active ingredients and there's 98% inert ingredients, that's clay or talc or some other carrier. They worked with 100% stuff in rubber suits, and they said, if you get one drop on you, sit down and start your last cigarette.
Oh, my God.
So I have a real hate for Roundup. because it's one of the most insidious chemicals that has ever been created on the face of this earth.
Wow. You know what gets me is their advertising on TV has shot skyward since that lawsuit. They're doing everything they can to just bullhead through it. Yeah, it's horrible. You know, I visited my father's birthplace 2 years ago. Well, it's where he grew up. It's in, well, he was born in Lincoln, Nebraska, but he grew up in Wyoming and Riverton. And I went and visited there, and it's sort of in central Wyoming, and rivers come through it, and river town, and then they go away. So there's a bunch of farming right there, and I visited the farm. It's owned by other people now, but I got to walk through the fields, you know, that my grandfather farmed 100 years ago now. It'd be 100 years ago. And what you said earlier about soil made me think about that. You know, it's organic beans or peas. I'm not sure which one they were growing.
Probably soybeans.
Soybeans, that's exactly what it was. They're kind of low to the ground?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the soil, I mean, it's not dirt. You know, you pick up some real soil and, you know, somebody like me who's, you know, I've never gotten my hands dirty, you know, you pick it up and it's like, wow, this is, you know, almost food. It's going to be food. The stuff that's in it is going to be food. And that's why I admire folks who can actually grow things, because I may have a tomato plant coming.
You'll have a tomato plant.
Thanks. I'll see if it works. I want to remind folks, we only have a few minutes left, and we are taking calls, 283-8414. I'm going to make sure this phone is actually on here so that we can hear your calls. If you have any questions about soils and growing things the right way, we have a panel of experts here, Velma Bittick, Abby Alla, and Lou Height, who represent many, many acres of things growing. Yes, Abby.
Well, you know, when Velma was talking about what's in your soil and how important your soil is, you know, I just got a piece of broccoli. I just got 3 weeks ago a piece of broccoli from the store. Now, if you pick a piece of broccoli out in the field, beautiful. You bring it in or have it in some sort of storage area, you have X amount of time before it starts to flower after it's been picked. Well, this has gone 3+ weeks, and it is nice and firm, and there's not a flower on it. My question is, what did they have to put on that broccoli to get it to stay like that?
Wow, because otherwise, if you picked it, it would be sprouting, right?
Yeah, and, you know, in all these lettuces you get in these bag mixes, you know, they stay nice and crisp for a long time. We have a CSA where we sell vegetables to different people, and we, you know, tell them very explicitly how to take care of your lettuce when you go home or your other greens so that it doesn't wilt, because real plants wilt. You know, nice, yummy thing you could walk through the garden and just eat.
Mm-hmm. Unlike those rock-hard tomatoes that used to come in the cellophane packs.
Mm-hmm.
Velma, with the look on her face, you remember those.
The sad thing about a tomato is when they bred the tomato to ship, you know, we're learning more about genes all the time. We can't just take out the gene that makes something soft or add a gene that makes something hard, because that gene that makes the tomato hard is the very same gene that gives it flavor. So now you can either have hard or you can have flavor, but you can't have both.
I've heard those referred to as round red tomatoid objects.
Mm-hmm.
What Abby was saying about the inhibitors that they put on produce, our produce is 6 to 8 weeks out, sometimes 6 to 8 months out, depending on exactly what plant it is, from when it was picked to when it got here. Steve and I grow a lot of potatoes. And back in Delaware, where we learned about potato growing, the potatoes are sprayed when they get big enough, they get sprayed with a vine killer. And they lie around in the soil for a couple of weeks and harden up. And then when they get dug up, they get sprayed with an inhibitor. And those potatoes will last 3 or 4 years.
What?
Yes.
If you keep them at 80% humidity and 33 degrees.
Oh, wow.
But yeah. You cannot take one of those potatoes and grow it. It won't sprout. So you can't use it as a seed potato. Oh. So you have to use a potato for seed that has not had any. It doesn't have to be a certified seed.
It should be, though, because if you don't, you're going to contaminate your ground with a disease that is in a potato that is not a certified disease-free potato. Mm. If you go to the store and you buy a bag of potatoes and they're sprouting and you decide you're going to plant them, in that 5-pound bag, you might have 14 potatoes, and they store those potatoes in storage sheds that are 80 feet wide and a quarter of a mile long. And every farmer within 15 miles is hauling potatoes into that storage, and they're mixed on conveyors and elevators, and then they're pulled out in the spring, and they are washed and loaded up. And when you buy a potato out of the store, you smell it, and it smells moldy and musty because don't plant them, because you could get a potato from 15 different growers, and they could be growing their potatoes. They have to use certified seed if you're a commercial grower, but they could be growing those potatoes in soil that has got viruses and disease, rhizoc and corky ring spot and nematode. And if you take those potatoes and you plant them in your ground, you have introduced all of those potato diseases into your ground. Don't do it.
Potato blights are a big thing, right? Isn't that a...
Well, that was the cause of the big famine in Ireland in the middle of the 19th century.
Yeah.
I mean, it's called the potato famine. And it was probably one plant that had a very contagious potato disease that wound up killing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people and depopulated a country.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure my ancestors came to America during that time.
Well, I know mine did.
Yeah. So.
The Irish potato is what they called a lumper. It was what we would call an early potato with a soft skin. Mm-hmm. And they were high water content. Those potatoes tend to be more susceptible to blight. But they were so prolific that the Irish didn't even plant seed potatoes. They just took the peelings, or they ate them raw. There were a lot of Irish peasants that never ate anything but a potato because they had been crofted by the English. So they would bite the eye out if it had started to sprout because they were bitter, and they'd throw them to the barrows on the side of the road, and they grew wild. But it was a high water content potato. There were no russet Burbanks then.
Ah, okay. And so that made them more susceptible to infection. Man. Potatoes in Alaska, I understand, are okay, though, right?
Oh, they're wonderful.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, there's a potato bank in Palmer, isn't there?
It's at the Alaska Seed Plant Materials Center.
Oh, okay.
And if you're going to grow seed potatoes, you're expected to get your initial seed potatoes from there after a rather detailed inspection to make sure that you're not going to put them in some place. If you're going to sell seed potatoes, you have to be inspected on a very regular basis.
Oh, wow.
And there's a grower in Homer that grows a lot of seed potatoes that are marketed here in this area.
Wow.
Yeah, in fact, we buy our seed potatoes from them.
Mm-hmm. What's the yield on a seed potato? Are they cut into pieces and planted, or do you plant a whole seed potato? Oh, okay.
Well, it depends on how big the potato is. We usually cut them up into 2 to 4 pieces, depending on how big the potato is.
Mm-hmm.
And each seed can produce anywhere from 4 to 10 pounds of potatoes.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy cow. Now, do you plant them where you keep adding soil on top? Do you do that style with the potatoes?
No, what we do is Steve built a gizmo. It's called a hiller that makes a little sort of an upside-down V mountain. And we plant them in that, and mid-season, he will come along and he'll up along the sides. Some people hill very constantly, but we don't that much.
Yeah, at the radio station I worked at down in Kodiak, there was a community movement for growing vegetables at your business, you know, for the homeless shelter and the women's shelter. And it was pretty good. We grew potatoes at the station, and we did it in tires, which I don't know if that's any good. But then the guy who was helping us, the actual guy who knew how to grow them, he said, okay, we're going to plant them here. The tires are going to warm up the soil. It'll be great. Then you can put another one on top of there. You can put more soil, then more soil, more soil. And then in the fall, you know, he comes over. He said, got us all together. He said, now we're going to knock it over. Mm-hmm. So we knocked over this big pile of tires and dug through the potatoes.
The only problem with the tire method is that some of the chemicals in the tires are, they're soluble and they will get into the potatoes.
Oh.
Yeah, so I was wondering you can about do that. The same thing by making squares out of lumber and build them up that way. You can even get grow bags, which is a canvas felt bag about 3 feet tall with a zipper on the side.
Mm. Wow.
Open the zipper and get your potatoes out.
And here's a little hint. Everybody buys potting soil, or they buy ProMix in the bales or whatever. Turn your sacks wrong side out, roll the top down, punch a bunch of holes in the bottom with a fork, and plant in the bag. But they have to have drainage holes in the bottom.
Wow. That sounds actually pretty clever, actually.
They're big heavy-duty bags,
mm-hmm.
and you can just put them in the sanitary landfill, so roll them down, make a collar, and plant in them.
I like it. Oh, then you mean you can roll it up as it's growing and filling them. Oh, of course I got it. Our phone number, if you would like to contribute to our radio station, is 283-8433. Operators are standing by. I want to thank Terry Hogan and Tina Minster, who called in the last hour during the Alan Boris lecture. Right now, we are at 283-8414. If you'd like to call in and have any questions about growing things the right way with our panel of experts, Lou Height, Abby Alla, and Velma Biddick.
You know, you were talking about growing potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Up until 63, my dad, we grew commercially potatoes, and we had up to 70 acres of potatoes here on our homestead.
Wow.
And the reason he quit growing potatoes was because the Army quit buying locally grown anything and was shipping their potatoes in from the States. And so Soldotna was so small at the time, there wasn't enough people to consume the amount he was growing.
Holy cow.
So.
That's amazing.
I'm not going to put a potato in a bag. I want to have a tractor, and I want my rope as long as I can get it.
How many acres did you say your father had for potatoes?
Well, he bought another 40 acres for potatoes, and then he had the original homestead, which wasn't very good, and then he bought another 150. But then after he bought that extra 150 out in Sterling, they quit buying.
Mm.
But we had a huge root cellar and
wow,
double row planters and double row diggers. And at age 11, I was the youngest and the only female certified seed grower in Alaska.
Holy cow.
And they'd have to come down and inspect my certified seed.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there like a 4-H then? Were you part of the 4-H? Or?
We were in the very beginning 4-H that there was. We didn't have a fair. You didn't take an animal and sell it at an auction. Our big thing was having a demonstration day.
Mm.
But, and, you know, mine was on growing potatoes. But, you know, it was the beginning of 4-H.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have three generations of kids in 4-H.
Oh, wow.
So,
what kind of things do you grow besides the cucumbers? Did you mention that before?
Everything that you can grow out of a seed catalog that grows in a cooler climate.
Except for okra. No okra.
No okra.
Well, but can it grow in Alaska?
No.
Oh.
Oh, well.
It blooms at night, and we don't have nights here, so it doesn't bloom. My husband's from Oklahoma. He loves okra. I'm from Idaho. I love okra.
I've never seen okra.
She doesn't grow here. I've tried everything, and I'm not going to put a sleep mask on it at night. So that's out.
You know what you mentioned about that, though? I heard that's the same deal with corn in Alaska. They need nighttime. Is that right?
You know, there's a lot of people that grow corn here.
Oh. Yeah. What kind of things are the... are we suited for in our climate zone as far as, you know, the different kinds of vegetables? You know, you go through the produce section, there's some weird things in there. Can you grow them here?
No dragon fruit.
Oh, okay. That was the one I was thinking of.
Brassicas, you can grow everything in the brassica family. That's your cauliflower, your cabbage, broccoli, all those things that you can't grow in Arizona or southern Idaho because it's too hot and there's too many cabbage moths.
Oh.
They grow up here wonderfully. Potatoes, root crops, beets, carrots. Corn is tender. Tomatoes are tender. Cucumbers are tender. Onions grow well up here if you get them in early enough because they're 100 plus days.
Oh.
Peas do well.
Legumes, chard, all kinds of lettuce.
But that's why the hoop houses.
Mm. How has hoop houses, I mean, that's a reasonably recent development, isn't it?
Well, I can remember when the hoops for just the rows were coming out, where you had a row crop cover to protect that row.
Right.
And you had little wires that you stuck in, and then you covered your row with it. And I thought I died and went to heaven.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, hoop houses different from greenhouses, and they're a lot more inexpensive, and you're growing in the ground or in raised beds that are connected to the ground. You don't have a fixed floor in them.
Oh, okay.
And you don't have heat in them other than passive solar heat.
Oh, really?
Your heat comes from your ground. It holds, and then it lets go of the heat at night.
Hmm, okay.
Yeah, there are some interesting passive solar heaters that, in fact, our friends in Homer that grow the seed potatoes have built some passive solar heaters for the backs of some of their hoop houses, where the sun just comes in, it heats up a couple of layers of window screen, and the air comes out warm. It's incredible.
We also run black tubing, plastic tubing, along the roof of our greenhouse, and it comes out boiling hot water.
Oh, you run through the hoop house?
Well, no, it's with a greenhouse. It's with our polyculture greenhouse.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I imagine it would heat up in there, mm-hmm. wouldn't it?
Yeah. But the hoop house boom that has happened really was the result of a program that the Natural Resources Conservation Service started about the time the hoop houses started showing up. And you have to jump. Oh, you're going to hate me. You have to jump through a lot of hoops to take part in it. But they will pay for it. And we have not taken advantage of that because you have to have a lot of money up front.
Mm.
But they will pay you back if you do all the things that they want you to. And a lot of people on the peninsula jumped on that one.
Wow. I know I have some friends in Homer, Hilltop Farms, and they, mm-hmm. she posts pictures all the time. Every time they do something, it's amazing. It is just about 1 o'clock. I want to thank Velma Bittick, Abby Alla, and Lou Hyde for coming in today and talking about growing things. It is, it's like juggling flaming chainsaws to me. I admire anybody who can do it, because I certainly cannot. And I'm glad you folks are here and are a resource, and I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for all coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
You bet. You are listening to Public Radio, KDLL, 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. We are listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. And listener support is what we're talking about today during our spring membership drive. If you'd like to contribute to Public Radio, give us a call at 283-8433.